Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of the channel, and I'm also the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And I'm very happy to say that today we have Aram Gutsuzian on the show. He's been on the show before. Today we'll be talking about his book, Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. This book has some of the most fascinating people in it I've ever read about. James Meredith is one of them, but Stokely Carmichael makes an appearance, and he's somebody that I think is very, very interesting, and I hope we get to talk about him, and I'm sure that we will. But before we do anything, let us welcome Aram to the show. Aram, thank you for being on.
Hey, Marshall. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Could you kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am now the chair of the Department of History at the University of Memphis.
For your sins, you're the chair of...
And I started that job this summer, and it is definitely a new challenge, that's for sure. I've been at the University of Memphis now for almost 10 years, and I teach courses in modern U.S. history, and the Civil Rights Movement, African-American history, U.S. history surveys, and I teach a lot of courses in our graduate. I'm originally from the Boston area, which fed my last book. The last time we talked was about a book about Bill Russell, the basketball player and the civil rights icon. And this new book is kind of a departure for me in the sense that while I've written about African-American history and I've written about the 1960s before in my previous work, this is my first sort of traditional political history to a degree with the Civil Rights Movement. And telling this very, in some ways, well-known story about the Meredith March, but also a story that I hope I've uncovered some new dimensions of.
Well, you have. Gutsuzian, that's an Armenian name, right?
It is.
It is. So how did an Armenian kid from Boston get into African-American history?
That's a good question. And it wasn't like I set out early in my life thinking that I was going to write African-American history. Yeah. I sort of came to it through some of my other interests as well. And the Russell book brought those together. I was always interested in sport history because sports dominates our existence in so many ways, and yet it receives so little scholarly attention. And it's always something I've been interested in. And more generally in the history of popular culture in America, and also writing about this more modern era in American history. So that drove me into more and more interest and fascination with African Americans. And I'm just trying to wrestle with this question of, you know, what it means to be an American. What does it mean to be a citizen of the United States? That's what really pulled me into African American history because, to use the John Hope Franklin's phrase, they hold a mirror to America.
Yeah.
Their plight is important, just or central, really, to understanding American history as a whole. So that was always the approach that I brought to it. I know that other people have come to it in very different ways, and I think there's room for all sorts of approaches in terms of how we sort of come to the subject.
Why did you write Down to the Crossroads?
Good question. I came to it really, I think, where I, coming to Memphis and being close to where that story was, and second, teaching a lot of courses on the Civil Rights Movement, and especially the graduate courses, where I was reading all these sort of new and interesting approaches to the Civil Rights Movement. People who focus in particular on local history, others who really are considering Black Power as something other than just simply sort of a demon that destroyed the Civil Rights Movement. Others writing in sort of an international framework. Others really focused on the issues of gender. There's all sorts of ways in which a generation, or maybe you could say two generations of civil rights historians have complicated sort of a classic story of civil rights history. But at the same time, sort of being grounded in, the more, especially teaching the undergraduate courses, being grounded in some of the sort of classic civil rights history that we've taught to our students. So the simplistic story I tell, it's not a direct line, but a friend of mine called me, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. He was at the Strand Bookstore in New York, Union Square.
83 miles of books.
Exactly.
They have some stuff.
And he's in the civil rights section, and he's not a historian. He's a scientist, but he's a guy who likes to read. And he just called me from there, and he said, "Hey, I want to read a book about the Civil Rights Movement. What book should I read?" And it was kind of a daunting question because, there's massive biographies of Martin Luther King, and there's textbooks, and I don't think he wanted to read a textbook. So obviously, I'm not trying to say that my book is the only book you should read about the Civil Rights Movement, but I tried to frame it when I sort of conceived of the idea is that if you were going to read one book about the Civil Rights Movement and you wanted to read something that was a story, something that pulled you along, this might be the kind of book that you would want to read. So I brought to it both sort of that academic dimension of trying to sort of synthesize these the modern scholarship on the Civil Rights Movement into more of a classic narrative story. Sometimes I call it the old civil rights history and the new civil rights history. I've tried to fuse the two to a certain degree.
Movie rights?
I've had some discussions about a documentary movie. I don't know about a Hollywood blockbuster.
I'm glad about that.
Yeah.
So, This is a book ostensibly about a march, one march among very, very many. And it occurs in, I think it's 1966, right? In the summer of 1966.
June of 66.
Yeah. And it's led by James Meredith, right? And James Meredith is most famous for something else. And that is that he was the first African-American student at the University of Mississippi, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ole Miss. Yeah. And I didn't really know that he had participated in this march, but I'm not a historian of this era. So can you tell us a little bit about Meredith and sort of set the stage for the march before we talk about what happens and how it is a pivotal moment? Because that really is the thesis of the book.
Mm-hmm. So James Meredith grew up in Mississippi. He grew up in a small town called Kosciuszko in sort of the hill country of Mississippi, but grew up in a very sort of with a unique upbringing for an African-American. His father owned land, his father was registered to vote, and sort of taught his children that they were sort of set apart, special, and really tried to insulate them from the white community. So he had this almost like a conservative aspect to him from an early aspect in his life. He saw himself as trying to sort of, when he was fighting against white supremacy, he was fighting on an individual level as much as a collective level. And he never really saw himself as part of a larger movement. At the same time, he really believed that he had the special destiny. He used the phrase divine responsibility a lot. So he had almost like a messiah aspect to him, a messiah complex. To him.
Mm-hmm.
He serves in the military in the 1950s. He's in the Air Force for a long period of time. And he returns to Mississippi intent on sort of staking his claim as a real U.S. citizen, just as the civil rights movement was kicking off. And he does it as an individual. He applies to Ole Miss and it ends up launching a big court challenge. But it starts with Meredith himself just simply applying to Ole Miss and determining that he wants to go there. It leads to, in 1962, this big constitutional crisis. Is the federal government going, do they have to protect one man's right to go to the University of Mississippi? At first they don't, and it leads to violence. There's a great mob develops there. White supremacists are arriving from all around the country. The upshot is that two people die and many people are injured in the midst of this violence, and James Meredith needs protection from federal officials for his entire year at the University of Mississippi. He only needs 1 year there before he can graduate. So he graduates in 1963. But then Meredith sort of struggles to find his place. He is sort of consumed with the notion of the civil rights movement, but doesn't see himself as part of it. He's a critic of nonviolence, people like Martin Luther King for exposing women and children to violence, that he thinks that the only way the black people will really get respect is to use force, because we're a militaristic nation, and this growing out of his experience in the military. But he can't really find what it is that he wants to do, really. He moves to Washington, D.C. for a while. He accepts a fellowship to Nigeria to study there in postgraduate work, but then he abandons it after 1 year. He moves back to New York. And he enrolls in Columbia Law School, but he has an eye on Mississippi politics. So in June of 1966, he launches this, what he calls a walk against fear, not a march, because he sees it as sort of a single man's endeavor, to walk from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. It's about 220 miles down Highway 51. And in doing so, he names two main goals. One is to encourage African Americans to register to vote. It's a year after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and there's finally seeing a slight uptick in terms of African-American voting registration patterns. And the other is to conquer what he calls a culture of fear. And that's obviously connected to the first issue of voting rights, that he wants black people to be able to sort of stand up for themselves and to reject the intimidation that they face from whites. So if they can see James Meredith, who is to white people perhaps the most hated man in Mississippi,
right,
if they can see James Meredith walking down a road for 220 miles and, you know, sort of coming to him and supporting him, then that might buoy their spirits and encourage them to assert their rights as well. This is the idea behind it. Mm-hmm. There's also sort of another motivation that he wants to further his political career as well. He envisions the idea that he'll make a lot of political contacts along the way, that it'll reestablish his name in Mississippi, and that by the time he finishes the march in Jackson, he'll have established a political base in about half the state.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this is an amazing thing. And so he was thinking, this was I don't want to be cynical about it, because I'm sure he was a true believer, but it was an effort to launch his political career.
To a certain extent, yes. I mean,
there's nothing wrong with that.
There's a positive aspect to it in the sense of the larger realm. But there is a personal aspect to it as well. And those two things, as he sees it, are absolutely interconnected. And this sort of goes to his vision, right? His idea of having a divine responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And did people counsel him as to whether to do this? Because it would be obviously dangerous, right? Am I wrong?
It's absolutely dangerous. Yeah, as the historical events were.
Right. I mean, do people say you really shouldn't do this? I mean, if you do it, you need protection and so on and so forth. And what did he say?
So he never asked the federal government for protection. What he does do is, and he does this with almost like a blind faith in Mississippi, he writes to the governor and he writes to various sheriffs of the counties in which he's going to pass through and says, hey, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to come through. I would like your protection. He basically gets ignored by 9 of the 10 sheriffs. One of them writes back to him and says, sure, we'll protect you. But the end result of it is that there is some protection for him, but he doesn't particularly ask for it. And there are a few people who march with him. And he says, you know, people are welcome to join me, but it's got to be men. They got to be independent. They got to be willing to take care of themselves. This isn't a mass march like Birmingham or Selma, where we're going to impose on a local community, where it's going to be a big media show. That's not what he sees as his main agenda.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so he starts the march and is with a few people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, yeah.
How does it go?
So the first day of the march, he leaves Memphis and he walks to the state border and they face some harassment.
And what day was that? I can't remember. It was,
he starts on June 5th.
June 5th. Yeah. Okay.
The next day is a Monday and it's the first day really in Mississippi. The first town that you encounter, if you walk down Highway 51, is Hernando. Small town, and he gets a very nice reception. There's about 150 black people who receive him there, and they cheer for him, and they encourage, they tell him that they're going to vote. And, you know, there's a crowd of hostile whites across the way who are watching this happen, and so Meredith is very proud, right? He's like, yeah, I'm achieving my mission here.
Mm-hmm.
He continues his march southward. He's about a few miles south of Hernando, and what happens? There's a man emerges from the side of the, road, shoots him 3 times. Use birdshot, which fires, you know, small little pellets.
Yeah.
And so Meredith isn't killed, but he's very severely wounded. He has about 60 birdshot pellets that are lodged in his back, in his neck, in his head, and he needs immediate medical attention.
Right, but as somebody who has some experience with shooting birds with birdshot, that could kill you. This is very dangerous. It's not. That will kill you.
And this becomes very interestingly an important controversy about sort of what the birdshot means, because the guy who shoots him is a guy named Aubrey Norville. He's still alive today. Still lives in the same house that he did then. He lives in a subdivision outside of Memphis, and he had no known connection to any white supremacist organization like the Ku Klux Klan or whatsoever. His neighbors and so on said they, you know, they weren't sure. He never talked about the civil rights movement. So it was unclear why he did this. And he has refused to name his motive since then. He ultimately pled guilty, spent a couple of years in prison, but has never really revealed his motive. So the interesting part about this, because he shot him with birdshot, on the one hand, civil rights activists are saying, oh, this guy's, you know, typical racist, typical white Southerner, maybe even had the Mississippi police in on it because while they were patrolling Meredith's march, they didn't stop this guy from shooting him.
It seemed
like they let it happen.
Right.
But on the other side, white segregationists are saying, oh, the civil rights movement must have paid someone to shoot James Meredith and just wound him with his birdshot.
I'm sorry.
Because that'll start this whole to-do, right? And it does start a big to-do in the sense of Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael and Floyd McKissick and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young. The giants of the civil rights movement are coming to take up Meredith's march. Now, obviously, that would be a very dumb conspiracy if that was the case. But the consistency of that rhetoric, that is constantly in the Mississippi papers, that you hear politicians talking about, oh, this was, you know, obviously some sort of put-up job, it's amazing to go back and read them.
Yeah, it is amazing. You're right. But it has, again, as you say, it would be an odd conspiracy because the shooting itself made it a national issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty much everybody flies in.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the convergence of these civil rights leaders and their interaction?
Sure. And it's important to sort of set the stage, I guess, in terms of where we are at in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, I was hoping we could do that,
Because on the one hand, you've got groups like the NAACP and the Urban League that are sort of want to advance their agenda and have developed solid relationships with Lyndon Johnson and the federal government. And there's a civil rights bill that's on the table in 66 that people have forgotten about that was – a whole number of things to help with jury trials and housing discrimination and so on. It was a pretty comprehensive civil rights bill that was then on the table. So they see this as a great lobbying tool. They think, oh, this will help us pass the civil rights bill, just like Selma had helped pass the Voting Rights Act the year before. And then you've got Martin Luther King and his group, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which are in the midst at that point of trying to organize a big campaign in Chicago. They're trying to take the tactics on nonviolence and apply them to this, the issues of class, really, in a big northern city in Chicago. So they're really concerned with issues of poverty and trying to sort of broaden the discussion of civil rights. And then you've got groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and the Congress Racial Equality Corps that have really drifted sort of to the militant edge of the movement. SNCC has always been especially sort of on the vanguard of the movement, dating back to the sit-ins of 1960, but by 66, they're trying to sort of grapple with some new questions as to who they are as an organization. They are frustrated with, in particular, what they see as the very slow pace of reform on a federal level. Yeah, these laws have been passed, but they're not being enforced very well yet. And they're very frustrated with what they see as a very tenuous alliance with white liberals who abandon them, in their time of need. So there are people like Stokely Carmichael, who's the new chairman of SNCC. He's made his name in Lowndes County, Alabama, where he's organized a political party that was a third party. Rather than integrate into the Democratic Party, which is basically a white supremacist party in Alabama, he figures, let's start our own party and create a black power base. And he's just starting to do that in Alabama. And he sees that as the vision for where black politics needs to go, whether it's the rural black belt or whether it's northern cities or what have you. Wherever African Americans are a potential majority, they need to organize into independent parties and then leverage their power in that way. And he's also adopting a more confrontational style, just in terms of rhetoric and in terms of challenging the white establishment. So these are all the groups that are coming to Memphis, giving speeches, meeting in the Lorraine Motel, the same motel where 2 years later Martin Luther King will meet his demise. Mm-hmm. They're meeting in the Lorraine Motel, in King's room, no less, basically trying to determine the future of the march. And what the key aspect here is that SNCC, in particular, is able to drive out the NAACP and the Urban League. Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young, the two leaders of those organizations, basically after the first day of marching, basically decide that SNCC is going to be impossible to work with. They've developed this manifesto that's exceptionally critical of the federal government, so they back out. So that leaves Martin Luther King as sort of the key moderating force on the march. So in my book, I sort of see that it's revolving in some ways around three main characters: James Meredith, Stokely Carmichael, Martin Luther King. That said, there's a massive cast of characters, from national figures to local people, to everything in between, that populate the book as well.
Mm-hmm. But Meredith is in the hospital, right?
Yeah. At this point, Meredith is in the hospital and exceptionally frustrated. On the one hand, the march is continuing, and he gives us this sort of his blessing because, he basically says they have the right to do what they want. But he won't sign his name to any document affiliated with the march. He won't be wheeled along in a wheelchair symbolically for a little while at the head of the march. And he basically says, you guys do what you're going to do. But he's critical of it because he says now it's become what he didn't want. It's become a mass march, mm-hmm. and it's going to impose on the local community. He's got all sorts of problems with it. Right. His other problem with it, of course, is that people are marching in his name, and he has no control over what's being now called the Meredith March through Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
or the Meredith March against fear.
Yeah. Well, so I want to keep taking steps backward just so we can contextualize what happens next. And I don't want to anachronistically set these two things off against one another, but I do want to make sure, because this is a focal point of the book, that there is a difference, and it's a growing difference. And that is between the tactics of King, whose motto is freedom now, mm-hmm. I think, and then the tactics of Carmichael and SNCC, whose motto becomes black power later. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about, we know a lot about King. Can you talk a little bit more about the evolution of the notion of black power? There's no Black Panther Party at this time, right? It doesn't develop until a bit later.
So,
is that right?
That is true. So yeah, okay. Carmichael's party in Alabama was called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization,
yeah.
but they had as their symbol a Black Panther.
Oh, really?
So okay. their yeah, nickname right. at the time right. was the Black yeah. Panther Party. This is a party in Alabama.
Right.
That is distinct from the Black Panther Party that develops in Oakland,
California,
which develops in the fall of 1966.
And
so it hasn't happened yet.
That's Bobby Seale and Huey Newton and other people
exactly,
that we know.
Exactly,
from, yeah, right.
Exactly.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So black power is a slow, those words, SNCC has been using those words and others have used those words as well. It's not like they're the first to craft those two words. But with their, they just recently had a sort of an organizational retreat that elected Carmichael as chairman. And in Alabama, they were talking about the slogan of Black Power for Black people. So the term had been sort of out there, had been percolating. Different organizers in different places have been using that term as well. But what the Meredith March did was it catapulted those words into a national slogan, because they really unveiled it as a chant as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
About midway through the march, they're coming into Greenwood, Mississippi, which is sort of at the heart of the Delta. Or I should say the gateway of the to the Mississippi Delta, sort of the large, flat, cotton-producing land. And SNCC has a long history of organizing in Greenwood. They've been there since the early 1960s. During Freedom Summer in 1964, it was at the base of their operations. And Carmichael has tons of local connections there. He was oversaw the whole operation in the Delta during that time. So that they very strategically choose to, when they get to Greenwood, end up holding a massive rally. There's about 1,000 people there, and that's when Black Power gets unveiled as a slogan. What do you want? Black Power. What mm-hmm. do you want? Black Power.
Mm-hmm.
And that launches it into the national consciousness. The media covers it. Media covers it in a new way, and Black Power comes to be seen as this new direction in Black politics among the young militants in particular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, what does the slogan mean? In some ways, it's connected to the larger strain of Black nationalism, right? That dates back to the 19th century. That you'd see in someone like Marcus mm-hmm. Garvey. That mm-hmm. you certainly see in Malcolm X, who was assassinated the year before this march. And Malcolm X is a hero to many of these young militants. So it certainly has elements of Black nationalism, but it's also a sort of specific to this era in the sense that it's growing out of the civil rights movement. It's growing out of the frustrations. With the civil rights movement that I mentioned before, sort of the notion of the slow pace of legislative reform and that's actually changing things on the ground and these frustrations with white liberals. SNCC itself has wrestled with the question of what to do with its white members. After Freedom Summer, there was a whole surge of white people who joined SNCC. But then the question was, is this still a Black organization? And if our goal is not to integrate into the fabric of American society, but rather to uplift Black people, then what does that mean? So they're wrestling with all these questions. But Black Power also has these very strong positive aspirations as well. The need for Black people to take control of their own communities, to sort of shed the yoke of paternalism to a certain degree, to express pride in their history and their culture. These are all aspects of Black Power as well. And there's also this in particular develops more of an international dimension to it as well, seeing the struggles of dark-skinned people who are oppressed across the globe as sort of interlinked with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all elements that sort of feed Black Power. But, you know, why do people start screaming back Black Power when he leads this chant? You can put it into sort of more basic terms. These are people who are poor and they're Black and they have no power.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a phrase that resonates with them, right? It's got sort of an emotional wallop to it so later on in the march, King is recognizing that Black Power has become this great controversy and the media is blowing it up into something and is just associating it with violence, and he's frustrated with that. He says, why don't we call it Black Consciousness or Black Equality? And Carmichael and McKissick are basically like, no, you know, this is the phrase that is resonating with people, right? This is the phrase that means something. So we mm-hmm. got to go with this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess one question I have, and you, I don't know if you can answer or not, but it seems to me, and this is from somebody who doesn't know a lot about the civil rights movement, although the civil rights movement as led by King, and I don't know a lot about it before then, is about bringing equality to Black people, that it has a kind of Christian understructure,
mm-hmm.
that it's powerfully Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Black Power removes that, doesn't it? It's taken out of that Christian context entirely.
Yes. In the sense that, you know, for King, he sees his mission as a minister as interlinked with obviously with his larger message of social justice. In fact, uh-huh. just before the Meredith March, on the sermon he gives at Ebenezer Baptist, the day that Meredith is starting his march, is basically about the role of the minister. It's a sermon called Guidelines for a Constructive Church. And he rejects the notion that a minister's job is to entertain or to make his congregation comfortable or to do anything like that. No, he sees it as, you know, helping the poor, helping the oppressed, and any way that they can do that, that's important. So, yes, I mean, obviously that is feeding his entire approach and ideology. And King's genius, really, is his ability to fuse this notion of Christian righteousness with the notions, with the rhetoric of American democracy, right? That he's able to try to bring those two together.
Yeah.
For most of the young militants, they tend to be more secular in outlook. They tend to sort of roll their eyes at this religious, King sort of, you know, rolling, sermonizing oratory. There's one story in when the march is in Yazoo City. And there's, by this time, the Black Power slogan's been unveiled and it's a big controversy. And And you know, they're sort of competing in their speeches for you know, what the meaning of the march is. And at one point, King is just delivering this very powerful speech, and one of the SNCC organizers rolls his eyes and yells out, "Blessed Jesus!" Like you know, like he's teasing him, right?
Yeah.
but the old black people from Yazoo City turn around and they just nod their heads. They're like, "Yes, yes, he is." You know, so you know, they're reading him in very yeah, different ways.
Right. That's funny. That's very funny. No, I just find that very interesting. I mean, I think one of the things that is not given enough, and this is sort of a digression, that is not emphasized enough in let's call it artifacts and writings about King is the degree to which he was really motivated by Christianity, that he was doing God's work. And but anyway, that's just my
Well, you know, the definitive one volume biography of King by David Garrow is called Bearing the Cross.
And it
really is sort of this, you know, that he it does sort of center around that notion.
Yeah, right. So at this point, the thing that is there is no Black Panther Party. There is this Black Panther symbol, but these people SNCC, it's not associated with Black nationalism. It's not anti-capitalist. It's not socialist. It's none of those things at this point, right?
It is not in the way that it will become. And certainly those strains are within SNCC from there. And there is it wouldn't necessarily define itself as such. And in fact, they take pains to say the Black Power is not Black nationalism during the march itself.
Right.
Even though it certainly has Black nationalistic aspects. So Black nationalism has been, sort of, I guess, tarred to a certain degree in the larger national conversation. So they're careful with that at first. It doesn't adopt all the dimensions that Black Power will adopt as it goes forward. But also you got to think about Black Power in not just that radical, sensationalized way, but Black Power also means if you're going by Carmichael's definition of sort of leveraging Black majorities, that helps elect Black elected officials, right? And that helps elect a Black mayor in Atlanta and Gary and Cleveland and all these places over the next few years. So Black Power means many different things to many different people, and there is no one definition. And the media wants to nail down a definition from Carmichael, so he keeps going back to these, you know, to this notion of Black political power, but he also refuses to reassure the media, and in particular about violence, because they're always trying to sort of pin his feelings down on is Black power violent?
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of refuses to answer the question, because he's not saying it as a violent revolutionary, but he also doesn't want to be cast as in King's aura of nonviolence.
Yeah.
Basically, he's trying to assert a right to self-defense, but he doesn't want to stop and reassure people, because he sees, you know, his job is to uplift Black people and to bring them along. It's not to reassure whites.
It strikes me as one of these cases where rhetoric is really powerful, because that expression, Black power, is going to get away from you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control that thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's ear candy. And or it's frightening ear candy. I don't know what that would be. Bad tasting ear candy for racists. Boy, that metaphor really got away from me. But you see what I mean. I mean, that expression, Black power, that must have frightened the hell out of people.
It did. I mean, it inspired people and it scared people. Depending on the audience, right? And for many white liberals, it made them exceptionally uneasy. And I should say for some Black liberals as well, they were afraid. What does this mean? It's not just the words, right? But it's how you're presenting them.
Right.
So the rhetoric is key here.
Yeah. Yeah. So we haven't talked about Stokely Carmichael at all. He's one of the most, I just think he's a very interesting fellow.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us his biography? Tell us a little bit about what brought him to this point.
Sure.
If you would.
So, he's born in Trinidad, comes to, raised in New York for much of his life. He comes to New York, I want to say when he's 7 years old. And he always is growing up in this somewhat sort of bohemian radical milieu. He goes to Bronx High School for Science, very prestigious school. And he's sort of around many of these sort of white liberals and radicals. And so he's got this sort of political texture to him early on. Then he enrolls at Howard University just at the beginning of the 1960s. And that's at a time when there's a group from Howard who are forming a group called the NAG, N-A-G, a Nonviolent Action Group,
mm-hmm.
that is basically like an arm of SNCC, just as SNCC is getting formed too. And they're active in a movement nearby in Cambridge, Maryland. And then Carmichael goes south with the Freedom Rides in 1961. He proves to be sort of a gifted organizer, in particular in Mississippi in the early 1960s. He has a gift for connecting with local people. He's the kind of guy who he has a real knack for knowing how to talk to different people. So, you know, in a northern city, he can often present himself more as a cool intellectual. But, you know, old black women in Mississippi absolutely adore Stokely Carmichael. Yeah. You know, he can be very polite and sort of a fake flirtation with them.
Yeah.
You know, he has a gift for connecting with people in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Very much shaped by sort of this international upbringing. He tends to, and he's a philosophy major at Howard, so he's a very thoughtful person. He's also the kind of person who he has very, people are within the movement are very loyal to him, but for others, he just simply rubs them the wrong way. John Lewis, I think, as well said that he either, I can't remember the exact quote, but either loved him or he provoked you. There was no in between. Like you fell in one camp or another with Stokely Carmichael. And he was always, he used nonviolence as a tactic, of course, as part of SNCC, but he was never someone who embraced it as a way of life. He never bought into sort of the larger King notion of a beloved community. So he's ideologically evolving over the course of the 1960s, but the roots of it are there in the early 60s. And so then, as I mentioned before, I should say he's in Mississippi during Freedom Summer. He's among those working for SNCC who are exceptionally disillusioned by the compromise at the Democratic National Convention in 1964. They'd organized their own independent party, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, because they weren't able to register voters for the white supremacist all white Democratic Party. And then they sent those delegates to the convention. And the Democratic Party basically just offered him two at-large seats and refused to recognize him as the official delegation because they were trying to hold on to the larger white delegation. They're afraid they'd walk out. So they go back to Mississippi, exceptionally disillusioned. They no longer want to work for reform on the federal level. They're disillusioned with Johnson, and that leads that drift into independent black politics for people like Carmichael. So he leaves Mississippi, goes to Alabama, and that's where he forms the Lowndes County Freedom Organization.
Mm-hmm.
He makes his name in Lowndes County especially, and that's what catapults him into the new chairmanship of SNCC in 66, right before the Meredith March, 1 month before the Meredith March.
Right.
He has a little bit of a profile before the March. You know, he's written an article, I think it's the New Republic, in which he says integration is irrelevant, and he's basically talking about some of the goals of the movement. And he's saying, integration is fine, but that's not really what this movement is about. He's sort of challenging sort of a white liberal perception of the movement. He's saying that the real goal here is for black people to be able to envision a new life for themselves and to leverage their political power to uplift black people, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's bringing that to the movement, and then the shooting of James Meredith all of a sudden provides this very unique opportunity. Now, SNCC by this time doesn't see itself as engaging in this type of mass march, right? That's kind of what they've defined themselves against. They see a mass march as sort of designed to bring together the various organizations and work with each other, and then to appeal to a national conscience and get media attention and do all these things. And he sees SNCC's goal as much more working on the grassroots, working with local people, trying to help them help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the mass march kind of goes against his idea. But then on the other hand, Meredith's shooting provides this bizarre opportunity because it gives them a chance to sort of go through Mississippi, where they've done already so much organizing, and it'll give them a chance to publicize SNCC's vision on a much larger scale. And they see this as a chance to also register voters, as a chance to do their kind of grassroots organizing
mm-hmm.
as they're moving along. So it becomes a hybrid for them.
Right.
So that's what Carmichael brings. That's why they ultimately decide to – they see this as a unique opportunity that we can unveil, especially the slogan of Black Power, on a larger scale. Because they have King with them, right? And where Martin Luther King goes, that means you have people, right? People want to come see Martin Luther King, and the newspaper reports with people at the time, that a lot of people say, like, yeah, I came up because I just wanted to see Martin Luther King. I didn't ever imagine I'd have a chance to meet him.
Right.
But also he brings national attention. He brings the media there, right? Mm-hmm. Wherever King goes, the media follows.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story that a photographer told me where most of the photographers were just, when the march was going along, they would just sit in the press truck that was at the beginning of the head of the march, and just keeping an eye on the leaders. And one of the other photographers, he would walk in, he'd walk among the marchers and take different kinds of photographs, more personal shots. And he asked the guy who worked for UPI, why don't you ever leave the press truck? He's like, I can't. I have to stay here in case King gets shot.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that just gives you a sense of how the media was really, sort of centered around Martin Luther King at that time.
Yeah. That's terrible. So, but before we leave Carmichael, I just want to make two things clear. So he has the slogan Black Power. But there are two things in his program that differentiate him strongly from King. One is that for him, nonviolence is not a principle. It's a tactic, right? I mean, it's something that you use, right? And he's not afraid to use violence. I mean, he doesn't talk about violence, but, you know, he's one of these, I'm reminded of what Obama likes to say, that everything is on the table, whatever that means. So, and then the second thing is that he's not an integrationist, really. He's just not an integrationist. And this is what separates him from all the white liberals, who are just all integrationists. He's like,
and if you think about King's core principles, right, they are nonviolence as a way of life.
Yeah.
And so, for want of a better term, racial brotherhood, right?
Yeah,
the notion that we're all part of one beloved community.
Right.
So Black Power, King never uses the phrase, because while he can agree with aspects of it and has been working toward many of those same goals, you know, Black political power and pride in your culture and your history, and he really embraces those ideas, and he can't say Black Power because to him it is a betrayal of his two key principles.
Right. Okay.
Violence,
okay. So did King know about Carmichael before he met him?
Oh, yes, yes. They had contact through the movement for years. You know, they've been in various organized campaigns together. And actually, right around this time, because Carmichael is elected to the chairmanship of SNCC, and they're both based in Atlanta, that's their home base for both organizations, King and Carmichael have a certain friendship.
Mm-hmm.
King has invited him to his home for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
They have so that on one level, the march is about about the way they push each other, but in other ways, it's about how they work together. They find common ground. That's also what gives the Meredith March's dynamism. If it didn't have King, it wouldn't have the same character, but if it didn't have Carmichael and SNCC, it wouldn't have ultimately electrified people in Mississippi the way that it did.
Right. How'd you like to sit down at that table in Martin Luther King's house with Stokely Carmichael?
Can you imagine?
I can, and I'm fantasizing about it right now. That would have been an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
So they come together. And what happens exactly? These two guys come together and tell us.
Well, when you think about the march, it's full of ways in which that, you know, sort of the merging of their visions. And I don't mean to just simply put it between the two of them, because this is obviously a march that involves hundreds of people and ultimately thousands of people. But there's all sorts of triumphs along the way. You know, they stage voter registration campaigns. They register people to vote. One of the first voter registration rally is in the town of Batesville. They get a man to register to vote who's 106 years old. For the first time in his life, he's going to vote.
Wow, he should get
to
vote twice.
This is a man who was born a slave.
Yeah.
When they get to the town of Grenada, there's a, you know, in basically every town in Mississippi, in the town square, there's a statue, a memorial to the Confederacy.
Sure.
And they put an American flag on the statue of this Confederate soldier, and one of the speakers refers to Jefferson Davis as that Joker. And you know, the whites are surrounding this rally and are just burning with anger.
Right.
They'll refer to this, James Eastland, the senator from Mississippi, referred to it as a desecration of the monument by putting an American flag on the monument. So there's a symbolic value there. And in Grenada, they really helped to start kickstart a movement. Meredith wanted to just go straight down Highway 51, but they detour this march into the Mississippi Delta because there's larger Black populations there. And that's really where Black Power gets unveiled. And then toward the end of the last week in Mississippi, the last week, this is a 3-week march essentially. The last week in Mississippi, there's two particularly dramatic acts, both involving violence. One of them occurs in the town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is not on the march route. It's in sort of south central Mississippi, or excuse me, west central Mississippi. But they take a diversion there. A group of marchers take a diversion there, including King, because it is the second anniversary of the murders of James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner, who had been killed just at the beginning of Freedom Summer. And they work with they'd organized in advance with the local political community, so they're going to lead this memorial march from the black district in Philadelphia to the courthouse. But the problem here is that along the march, they've been protected by the Mississippi Highway Patrol, the state forces. When they go to off the route march, is basically under the control of the local police. The local police include Cecil Price and Sheriff Rainey, who are the same police officers who are then under federal investigation for the murders of these civil rights workers, and who are in fact associated, as we'll later learn, affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan. So they receive very little, very minimal protection. And what happens is that basically a mob attacks the marchers. The cars whiz by them. People throw things at them. They throw cherry bombs at King as he's giving a speech, and people think that he's been shot. King will later say that it was the most scared he'd ever been in his life. And as the marchers have given their speeches and are leaving, they basically, a mob starts wandering into the march itself. Some people are wielding weapons like blackjacks and so on. So they're basically able to, before a full scale riot breaks out, they're basically able to escape back into the Black District. But it's terrifying, and they call for federal intervention. They want Lyndon Johnson to get involved, but Johnson essentially ignores them. By this point, he's grown quite alienated from the civil rights movement, and he's not associating with the Meredith March at all, because people like Stokely Carmichael are openly critical of the federal government. He doesn't see any political benefit in getting involved in this one way or the other. He obviously can't side with the marchers, and he obviously can't side with the state of Mississippi, right, which is, neither one is going to help him. So he's trying to remain aloof from this as much as possible. But once he refuses to use any federal protection, as we get to the last week of the march, when the marchers get to Canton, Mississippi, which is about 30 miles north of Jackson, their final destination, mm-hmm. It's a few days before the end of the march. And along the way, the marchers have tried to camp on land. They have these tents for each part. They tried to set up their tents and camp on land that is in the Black community, that is public land. And they do this for very symbolic reasons, right? Black people pay taxes. They have a right to this land. It's within the Black community.
Right.
You've segregated us. Let us use this land. So they try to do so in Canton. They've been banned from doing so by the local superintendent. They do it anyway, and they expect a confrontation when they try to get on the land, and there is none. So they start to put up their tents. The rally is huge by this time. It would set up 2,000-3,000 people because we're nearing the end of the march. Then all of a sudden, the Mississippi Highway Patrol roll up, tons of cars in their riot gear, and they start launching tear gas. And they don't use tear gas as crowd control. They don't use it to just scatter the people. They're launching it right into the marchers themselves. People are getting hit with tear gas canisters. It is an absolutely brutal attack. And then the highway patrol marches right into the field and starts beating people, hitting them with nightsticks, kicking them, dragging them into ditches. In the words of a Time reporter, Arlie Shard, it was like a scene from hell. And the stories, this is one of the most extraordinary, most gruesome attacks within the civil rights movement. But it doesn't get the same media attention that 1 year before Bloody Sunday, the Selma March across the bridge, when they had been attacked by tear gas, that became a national story. And Lyndon Johnson delivered a speech, where he said the words, "We shall overcome," and it helped to lead to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. There isn't this case in Canada. So again, the federal government ignores it. It sort of fails to rouse the conscience of the nation, because the march by this time is at least halfway associated with Black militancy and with Black power. So in these two sort of gruesome instances of violence, it doesn't translate into federal action in the way that we'd seen in previous marches.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what, now Meredith has been in the hospital for most of the march, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not gone the way he wanted it to go at all.
No.
Yeah, no, it's been hijacked.
Right. Well, I mean, I should say he was in the hospital for a few days. He was recuperating at home for a significant amount of time.
Okay, yeah, right. But
he'd occasionally give a press conference or something like that while the march was going on, basically criticizing the march. But then he does return to the march for the last few days. And he makes a point of not returning until the marchers loop back onto Highway 51, which was, again, his plan. He was never going to march in a part that wasn't part of his original plan.
Mm-hmm.
But then he gets really angry at the end of the march because he had been told that he would lead the march out of Canton to the next stop, which was Tougaloo College, which is a college just on the north edge of Jackson. But the marchers had already gone on without him, and he was furious at this. So the next day, he decided he was going to lead his own march from Canton to Tougaloo because he had promised people that he would. And again, this is a guy driven by his own individual initiatives. So he is with the march for the last few days. And Meredith is, in some ways, he's a great hero at this time, right? He's the most associated with the march. He wins the loudest cheers at the final rally. He's an important figure in this time. The march has resuscitated his national profile. So it's very interesting to see where Meredith goes from here. He fails to exploit that political capital.
Uh-huh. But he tries to have a political career, doesn't he?
He does. And he makes a series of, at one point he runs as a Republican, at another point he runs as a Democrat. There's conservative aspects to him. There's liberal aspects. There's radical aspects.
He's a very interesting character.
Yeah. Later in his life, he gets associated with conservatism on the far right. He briefly works for Jesse Helms.
Jesse Helms.
In the 1990s, he at one point endorses David Duke, the former Klansman, running for political office in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he's a guy who lives in Jackson now, is in the heart of the Black community. Mm-hmm. He's in some ways very well respected. He's led a life that is difficult to put into boxes or into categories.
Yeah, that's absolutely
true. Tough guy for a historian.
You
only get a slippery grasp on him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely true. So he's one of the triumvirate. You say it's a book about King and Meredith and Carmichael. So we know what happens to Meredith. He tries to have this political career after the march. And, it's hard to summarize exactly what he does because he does not play the role that you would think someone with his sort of demographics would.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and I encourage anybody who was just go look up James Meredith and you'll see what we mean. Really hard to predict. So, King, you can just summarize what happens to him.
Well, certainly, I mean, the march is important for King in the sense that it sharpens his understanding of the deep poverty in rural America in Mississippi. He's moved by so many of the scenes he sees, and this is helping to shape what will ultimately become his Poor People's Campaign that he's planned for 1968, which brings him back to Mississippi and ultimately helps to bring him back to Memphis, because when he comes to support the sanitation worker strike here, in 1968, he's doing so, saying that this is linked to the larger goal of the Poor People's Campaign. So he returns to the scenes of the march, somewhat tragically, obviously, with his assassination in Memphis. But he's also resolved that they were going to launch for the Poor People's Campaign. They're going to have these mule trains that we're going to leave from various parts of the country. And he said the one should leave from Marks, Mississippi, where he delivered a sermon in the midst of the Meredith March, and where he came back to. While planning the Poor People's Campaign, was again moved by the poverty that he saw. And Carmichael, the third of these, Carmichael, I guess, main characters, right? The Meredith March catapults him. It turns him into basically the heir to Malcolm X in the public eye, both among his black followers and among his conservative detractors. And it changes SNCC because they never really had this type of charismatic leader before. It's an organization that had defined itself against that sort of one signature leader. But Carmichael is using his profile to sort of try to elevate SNCC and to try to raise money and to try to raise resources and publicize Black Power. But with the Black Power movement going in so many directions, SNCC ultimately splinters. There's a bizarre, ill-fated alliance with the Black Panther Party among some SNCC members that doesn't pan out. Carmichael moves to Africa and develops a sort of a notion of Pan-African socialism. He changes his name to Kwame Ture. He's named himself after his two main mentors in Africa, Sekou Ture and Kwame Nkrumah. And he passes away in the 1990s.
Yeah, it's a fascinating character. Very fascinating. So is it fair enough to say that after this moment that the civil rights movement is split?
It's, I call it in the book, the last great march, in the sense that it's the last time that that the major civil rights organizations will come together for a common endeavor. It's the last time they'll try to launch this type of sustained demonstration that is designed to appeal to a national audience and get national media attention. You'll never again see the organizations work together in this framework again. So, yeah, absolutely. In that sense, the civil rights movement has. You know, King says at the end of the march, or one of his advisors says, you know, we can never really work with SNCC again. So there was, there's a creative tension that came out of the march, but by the end, they're too far apart. So there's the march is both a beautiful story and a tragic story. It's a very interesting time.
Yeah, it is kind of an amazing thing because it's one of these events that shows you the importance of contingencies, because had Meredith not been shot, it probably would be a footnote. But yeah. I mean, everything mostly rode on that. And when that happened, then, it got on the front page of the Washington Post, and then Carmichael shows up and King show up and then it has kind of a momentum all its own.
So the tensions within the civil rights movement are there, right? It's not like SNCC didn't have the ideology that it did, and they had the slogan Black Power, and King was King, those philosophical differences that existed for years and had widened by 66. So it's not like, I don't mean to just say that the march, made that happen. But what the march did was it basically created this, it jammed everybody together, and it created this sort of three-week moving laboratory of black politics where they're constantly in debate with each other, and there's a national media presence, and there's all this pressure from about, you know, are they going to get attacked the next day by a white mob? Is there is a Klan coming? Or how are they dealing with white officials? They got to negotiate everywhere they go about what land they can use and where they can hold the next demonstration. Yeah. And I think, you know, in the way that we've had a conversation, we've been talking about these three main characters, but this is not just a book about those three people. It's about hundreds of people. I interviewed 100 people for the book itself, mm-hmm. and most of them were marchers of one stripe or another. So there's all sorts of local stories that are central to this. So when I talked at the beginning about this idea of the old and the new civil rights history, right? There's a lot of emphasis on local history. My argument at times in the book is that the politics of these local communities, the way they handle the Meredith March, has national implications, right? Because, you know, what they do in Grenada, or what they do in Greenwood, or what they do in Canton, right, with the attack, that has massive implications for the future of black politics.
Well, Aaron, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you very much for writing the book and being on the show. I want to close the interview by asking our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Oh.
I've never gotten that as a response.
So, since I finished the original draft of the book, I literally finished the first draft of the book, and then my wife gave birth to our first son that next week. And I had a lot of childcare duties with him right at the beginning, because my wife was finishing her dissertation. And then we had a second child soon after that, and then I started as chair of the department. So yeah. I have... failed to develop much momentum on a new project. I've been working on a few essays here and there, but my next big book project is undetermined.
Watch the space. Yeah, absolutely. Watch the space. So yeah, you sound like a very busy guy. So we're not don't worry about it. I'm sure the university is very happy with your work. Very, very pleased. So let me first say we've been talking with Aaron Gutsuzian about Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. And let me say thank you very much for being on the show, Aram.
Marshall, thanks so much. I always enjoy talking to you.
Absolutely. And then let me say to all of our listeners, thank you very much for listening. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History and the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And I hope that everybody has a great week.